Specialist on Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome back to the Daily Traditionalist. Today's date is the 29th of June 2017 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. I do apologise that we haven't had any Daily Traditionalists for a while. It's been issues at my end. Hopefully things are going to improve. We've got a good lineup for next week. We've got Jez Turner, Yohani Karanen, Messerschmitt, and we also have Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, who is joining us today. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Sven.
Good. I'm glad to hear. We all have these issues every so often. It was my turn this time, but things are looking up now, and we've got a great show in line for you all today. We've had a request from Okama from Bulgaria, who is a regular in the Radio Aryan chat room, and he wanted to know about the Great Schema or the Megalo Schema. Now, the Schema are these Orthodox monks. Probably not all Christians are aware of them, but I think most people have probably seen them. They look almost like a death metal band. They wear these black robes with these hoods with all these symbols on them. I mean, they look pretty cool. And whenever people see them, they wonder just what it is these guys are, what it is that they do. They look really interesting. They look like they have a really interesting story behind them. And who better to ask about this than yourself, Dr. Johnson? So, yeah, please tell us about the Megalo Schema, the Great Schema. Who are they and what do they do?
Well, I've been studying monasticism for a long time because these were the Western world's first attempt at, utopian socialist community. And from a secular point of view, that's exactly what they are. And unlike other forms of that kind of experimentation, the monastic form has worked. In America, it's been a bit of a problem, for men anyway, not so much for women. But Mount Athos is the center of monasticism in the Orthodox world in Greece. And CNN, 60 Minutes had a chance to do it took a long time for them to get down there to do a special. And they were there, and they were told to do a hatchet job on them because it was all male. No women were allowed, stuff like this. And they couldn't find anything to criticize. And in fact, two of their members stayed and wouldn't come home. One is still there and has become a monk himself. On Mount Athos, the average lifespan is about 96 years. Disease is almost entirely unknown. There's tremendous physical exercise as well as mental exercise throughout the life of the monastic. It's very hard to get into because it's all mountains. There's a lot of physical, exertion and a very, very limited diet. They don't bathe, but they don't smell because they don't eat the kind of processed foods that we do. Their diet is very, very limited and it's usually just vegetables and certain types of fruit that grow in that part of Greece. It's a completely different world that no one knows anything about. There's a doctor there, a monastic doctor on Athos, that has nothing to do because these guys never get sick. And having a 100-year-old monk on Athos is very, very common. And he's still very strong. So this is an extraordinary thing. My spiritual brother, so to speak, Schema monk Brendan. In New Jersey. And we got to know he's dead now. We got to know each other very, very well. And the Great Schema is given, only to the most advanced monastics. Many monastics never reach that level. It's, for monks who have shown such a tremendous degree of asceticism that it's superhuman. And that's the only way you can get one. And you're clothed in essentially what is a church draped around you, and all these symbols. You have the rooster, you have the pillar, for example, is another one. You have the ladder, the nails. Adam's skull is always on there. The reed and the sponge from the crucifixion. And then there's a series of abbreviations going up and down the external row. I mean, a whole bunch of different things, different themes in the Christian life. And the monks are, especially at that level, are treated as warriors instead of a soldier with weapons, fighting a visible enemy. They're soldiers fighting an invisible enemy, and they're treated in the same way. And so many soldiers have retired to monasticism after their careers are over. And it's a seamless transition most of the time, because it's combat one way or the other. The soldier is living a Spartan ascetic life regardless. It goes with the territory. So they're very similar in that respect. But calling them warriors against the unseen evils is a very common way, and it makes a lot of sense from that point of view.
So they have.
So that's the thumbnail sketch of it all.
So they have like superhuman strength, this asceticism that they're involved in. Could you tell us some more about what asceticism is and what sets them apart from the other ascetics in the community?
Well, to a great extent, asceticism is a heck of a lot more than just self-denial. It's rebellion against the world. It's rebellion against the power structures that exist. It's rebellion against degeneracy. It's rebellion against mediocrity. It's rebellion against the idea that the only things that we live for are, you know, pleasures of the flesh and the stomach and everything else. And they realize one important thing, and that is that when you're a hedonist, an outspoken one or just an implied one, you're never satisfied and you're never happy. You can get, you know, a constant supply of whatever it is that you love, and you'll never be happy. You'll never be satisfied. It's irrational. Hedonism is irrational for that reason. These guys have discovered that the sorrow and pain that kind of life brings with it is in fact a source of joy when you can transcend it. Fasting is the main weapon. And the secular point of view is that fasting permits more oxygen to reach the brain. When it's weighed down with food, I mean, no monk can eat meat ever. And no, generally speaking, they don't eat dairy products either. They do on occasion. They don't drink, not in the sense that we mean. And, yeah, they only have two meals a day at the most. And during Lent, they only have one. Every Wednesday and Friday, they only have one. And you know, given the size of the American portion, they eat at every meal, Americans are so overfed. And this definitely has an effect on how people think. It soaks up the strength, the available oxygen in the system. But even secular Greeks, up until recently, if they were going to make an important decision, they would never do so unless they fasted for a week. What eventually happens is that once your body gets used to the small amount of food, that there are flashes of euphoria because of the huge amount of oxygen that's now available for your brain. You think a lot clearer. You think a lot more quickly. The fact is that the hedonistic life weighs you down. It makes you stupid. It brings the, you know, it's easy to say that, you know, there's the old saw that the human being only uses, you know, let's say 15% of their brain. And that's probably much less given the American lifestyle. But given the ascetic lifestyle, the eating not very often, they're using, you know, 60% of their brain. And they're able to see things. Once you are no longer weighed down with that, with the cares of life and food and all that, you see more things. Your senses are heightened beyond the average person. And this is why that these people can see angels and demons. You know, these people are quite sane in everything they say or do, but they just have a greater a field of vision because their brain isn't weighed down with food and the concerns of life. I think that adults in the modern West are so hung up on things like reputation and money and paying bills and women and everything else that they're only programmed to see a very, very small portion of reality. But these people, through that kind of asceticism and self-denial, and lack of care. Because everything comes from God, so if they suffer, they suffer. They have these people can see a tremendous amount more than we can. They're not being programmed by the system. They're not being, their thoughts aren't canalized into approved channels. They're more, they could see things that are actually there, but we can't. I mean, we know that you only could see a tiny percentage of the light spectrum. We're so limited in our senses. And partially it's because of this oversaturation with worry and care and economic life and food and everything else. Even to the point that Americans have to work out to an exercise to burn off the excess calories because we just have too much indulgence. So these people, and I've met many of them, I've known many of them, are pretty much the same. I've never met an unhappy one, even though their lives, from a simplistic point of view, are very hard. So they could simply see more things than we can. There's no doubt about it.
I should imagine that enables them to be a lot more objective about things. Instead of thinking about things subjectively or being possessed by anything, because they have no possessions, they could look at things from a detached point of view. And the smaller things in life, just life itself, would be enough to bring them joy, I should imagine. So these are the ones right at the very top. Are there? I've been looking into this today. So there are another two different orders that make up these monks. There's just the Orthodox monks, and there's the Great Schema at the top. Another two other orders beneath them, apprentices and neophytes or something.
Well, Stravafor comes before. I mean, there's a little schema. Which you get roughly at middle age, which is a fully professed monk. Most of them will not get the Great Schema. You know, you can live a perfectly respectable monastic life and never reach that point. And prior to that is the Stravafor, or the Crossbearer. They're not fully professed yet, but they're very close to it. The degrees prior to that, the Novice and the Rasafor, are not fully professed. They're still in a trial stage. The abbot has to see if these people are really capable of living this kind of life or not. They need to see if they fit in. They need to see if they have to worry if this person has just given up on life and this is the only thing that's left for them. They think it's going to be easy. They have to weed those people out, and these people have to be driven. If they're not driven, they can't stay. And the great thing about these degrees, really, they're based on humility. They all have, very menial tasks around the monastery. I mean, you have to be impressed, no matter who you are religiously, that wherever the monks have gone, they've created civilization. They've completely cleared entirely wild areas. Western Europe was built by the Benedictine order. Well, wherever they've gone, they were able to create the rudiments of civilization so other people could come and then settle. There is no civilization without the monastics. There is no literacy without the monastics. The Benedictine order in Western Europe saved all the works of both pagan Rome and Greece and the church father. They're the only reason that we have, good translations of the pagan writings as well. So they've always been a threat. And remember something too, the monastery can be very large and wealthy. That doesn't in any way mean that the monks themselves are. The monks may not possess anything. And there's always been strict guidelines for how to maintain that. So it's stupid. Some people will say, even historians will say, that these monks have grown wealthy and everything else. Well, the monastery might be. But inside, your life hasn't changed at all. And these monks, these monastics have grown, the establishment has grown wealthy because of donations. Because it's much easier to work for them than to work for a private owner, in the Middle Ages and afterwards. And in Serbia, medieval Serbia, you were exempt from military service if you were working on the lands of a monastic house. So there was always incentive to be with them. And so they grew very, very quickly. And really what you see because of this is these cycles of, very intense, deep asceticism. Then they get too much and they grow too quickly. And then they get a little bit lax. and then a reformer comes around and knocks them back down to size. And in the West, you've had the orders like the Cistercians who made war on the Cluniacs. The Cluniacs, in their mind, had become simply too wealthy. These monastic houses were far too establishment-oriented, connected with political power, and the Cistercians wanted to strip all that down and make it. They're still Benedictines, but you know, you see this in the East as well. They get a little bit too lazy, and then a reformer starts over again. So they go in cycles, like most of us. And there's always a new person in there to return the monastic orders to their roots again when they have gotten too, when they simply have possessed too many things, they've gotten too wealthy for their own good.
Well, that's one of the things I was going to ask you about, actually. Obviously, you have different groups of monks like Cistercians or Franciscans, Benedictines. That's Roman Catholic monks. So these great schema that are at the top, has there always just been this one Orthodox monks, this one group of Orthodox monks right the way through? Or has there been like spin-off groups like the Franciscans, the Benedictines, like we have in Roman Catholicism?
Not de jure, but definitely de facto. Right. There are orders in the East, amongst the Byzantines and Russians. The Athenite rule is different from the rule of the studion that was mostly Russian and Greek. The Hesychasts, for example, who are intense ascetics, function very differently than your sort of normal monks of the studio. They're called the studion. So there are orders de facto, but they're not really orders in any kind of like you have, you know, Cistercians and Cluniacs and Trappists and things like that in the West. So technically there's not supposed to be any orders, but they have developed anyway. Different monastic houses stress different things. That has to do with their founders and the charter. But each monastery has its own charter. It has to be approved by the bishop. It usually comes from St. Basil the Great, and to some extent, Jerome, who lived in the desert most of his life. And they differ. They're not identical in each case. And so it really depends on what their mission is, what their focus is. Sometimes it's scholarship. Sometimes it's helping the poor and the sick. They invented the hospital, for example. They invented the library in our modern sense of the term. So in the West, you have these orders with different hierarchies and different charters. But in the East, each monastery runs itself. And you have different specializations over time. So, yeah, there are de facto orders of Eastern monks, yes.
Well, how far back does history go then? Does it go back right to the beginning of the church, or did it come about later on, 400-500 AD? How far back does it go, this history of these orders of monks living together in community and farming the land and living in asceticism and providing for the poor? How far does that go? How far back does that go?
Well, that goes back to the Old Testament. Every civilization has had something like this. People who just can't take the day-to-day life of the ordinary. It's as old as the church is, at least for Christians. And the one thing that they all have in common is that they're not married and they don't have children. They can't be weighed down with that kind of care. They don't want to have any leverage used against them. But becoming powerful the monastery, not the individual monks, is always a check on the aristocracy. It's always a check on the state. When a monastery became powerful and wealthy, it became more active. They were able to build more things. In Russia, the average monastery had between 500 and 700 poor people that were dependent on it and giving it away. Because of the division of labor, they were always so extremely efficient. There was no laziness. Everyone had a mission and a purpose. Every single monk in the East, no matter what his background, has to work with his hands, has to have some literally menial job to do. And the division of labor is very strict, and they outperform every other body. And they really couldn't compete. I mean, secular landlords couldn't compete with them. But they were a check on the nobility. They were a check on the state. They were a check on everything, even a check on the bishop. So, in the Middle Ages, you had this tremendous, not just division of labor, but also checks and balances amongst different powers in the church and outside of it that kept it stable. And it's very important to note.
Well, you mentioned there about the celibacy. So it was this young men that took vows that they would be celibate for the rest of their life, or was this people that had already been married and had children and then took vows? And also, what about women? Do they have the equivalent of the Roman Catholic nuns?
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah, in America, for whatever reason, nuns have done better than male monks. They're all monks. They have to be separate. They can't live anywhere near each other. And then the male priest that goes to the female monastery has to usually be elderly. So that there's no problem there. Hearing confessions can be a problem. Normally what happens for women, because most men, myself included, probably shouldn't be hearing female confessions. They'll confess to their mother superior. The mother superior will go to the male priest and say, okay, she's good. And then he'll give absolution. That's how that interaction works. Female monasticism was a way that women could become very, very powerful very quickly. And there are many charismatic female monastics and leaders of the church. An abbot of a powerful monastery is just as powerful, if not more powerful, than a bishop is. And I know the late Mother Anna, who had the monastery Marcia in Cleveland, dedicated to St. Gabriel, was the most powerful person in the Serbian church in the East Coast. And Bishop Mitrofan, who was a friend of mine, was a bit intimidated by her. She had been arrested much older and formidable. And it was really hard for him to do a whole lot without running things by her. That's not dealt with as often as it needs to be, that these female monastics become extremely formidable opponents for any bishop to have to deal with. And you don't become an abbess of a female monastery without being very, very strong-willed. And they're all elected positions. All the abbess and abbot are all elected. They're elected for life, and they can be removed. There's a chapter meeting every day in both Eastern and Western monasticism. So it's very democratic in that sense. But the abbot does rule, once elected, with an iron fist, unless he falls into heresy or the bishop sees other problems developing there. Technically, the bishop rules monasteries. At the same time, bishops are usually chosen from abbots of monasteries. So it's something they usually check each other. Depends on who has more power, who has more resources. And in the Middle Ages, it mattered how holy you were. That itself was a huge increase to your prestige. If you're seen as this extremely humble miracle worker, that actually mattered a lot, and who was listened to. Monks were always more popular than any other aspect of the church or the state in the Middle Ages, and even up to the modern era. Monks were seen as approachable, and they were seen as ordinary people, which of course they always were. You could approach them if your own landlord or if the nobility was getting too arrogant. Going to a powerful monastery could often be a great source of relief.
Well, I know in the Middle Ages and before, actually in the Saxon times in Britain, a lot of the kings, their princes, would take vows of celibacy, and the princesses, they would take vows of celibacy, and they'd be put in charge of bits of land and monkeries, or whatever it is that they actually call them, these orders. And the abbots themselves, then the monks would swear to obey them. They would swear to obey them in whatever it is that they said. So is that similar to in Hinduism, when you have a guru and the apprentices swear to obey the guru in whatever the guru tells them? Is it a similar sort of role that these abbots would play?
I'm not sure so much about Hinduism. I never thought Hinduism as a religion. I saw it more of a philosophy of life and an ontology and a poetry rather than religion. The monasteries in the East are educational institutions far more than religious institutions, the way that we would use the term. But there's a difference between a spiritual father and an abbot. Sometimes they're identical. In my experience, they've always been identical. But But in a larger monastery, the abbot is somebody who has a great degree of practical knowledge and ability. They know how to work with money. They know how to talk with people. They know how to actually be a businessman. That's not the same kind of personality that's going to be your spiritual guide. So in Russia, places like Optina, for example, the spiritual father was someone far more humble and far more closer to the population than the abbot. And the spiritual father always outshone the abbot no matter what. One was a practical worker, absolutely necessary. The other was an idealist, equally necessary. And the back and forth, you know, the spiritual father usually won that prestige battle because the spiritual father was usually non-noble populace from the common people. Oftentimes an abbot would be from the nobility. So there was even a check and balance system within the monastery itself, depending on how big it was.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the vows that they take as part of their asceticism. A part of it is the vow to obey the abbot. And I was just thinking that was similar to over in India, they take vows to obey their guru, and the guru teaches them and gives them these tasks that they have to carry out. And it seems to me that the abbot does a similar thing and gives the monks these challenging tasks to carry out. And you hear, especially over here in Britain, you hear of these monks that would immerse themselves in freezing cold water up to their necks for 12 hours a day while reciting scriptures, and these great challenges to the actual physical being. I think there's an echo of that still today in Russia. People will go swimming in the iced water, and it's part of the church traditions there. I think on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, they go diving into these ice cold water. So they have these physical challenges, trying to put their body through the harshest regimes possible to bring themselves closer to God. And I just see there's a similarity there between some of what they try to do over in India. I just think that there's this right the way through Aryan history, there's been a part of religion. There's been people that rejected the world and put their bodies to great tests in ways that they could come closer to God. And also involved in all of that, we've been providing for the poor, which is sort of what you were saying there, linking it back to the way that this goes right back to the Old Testament. Is there much mention of that sort of thing in the Old Testament, Matt?
Well, that's what the prophets were trying to do. Israel, as a nation, was supposed to be a monastery. They were supposed to be relatively poor. They were supposed to live according to the law. You know, the charter that you find in Deuteronomy, for example, to have very little outside contact. Isaiah was angry that they wanted alliances against the Egyptians. Even though it was a very small country. Any connection with the outside world to the prophets was an outrage. Israel's small, but you have to trust in God, not in the size of the army. And in the story of Gideon, for example, it proves that. Moses, with his hands held high, proves that. The fact that they were so radically outnumbered when they got to the Holy Land, outnumbered by these settled, very strong empires. God takes care of the situation, not force of arms. What the prophets said was, you abandon God when you think that security is going to be found in alliances with others, in trading, in money, and the prestige, the respect you get from other world powers. And Israel, just like all of us, you know, fell into that sin over and over and over again. And the prophets said, God has lost his patience with you, and he's going to bring up the Egyptians or the Babylonians to destroy you. And so the prophets saw the Israelite community as a monastery, not a nation state in the sense that we would use the term today, and certainly not as an empire. So, you know, this is the whole mentality of, even in old Russia, the entire nation was supposed to be a monastery. Every word, every movement was ritualized. This was a way to get an ideal, translated into the real as smoothly as possible. You know, we could have all the great ideals in the world and goals, but if we can't incorporate that into day-to-day life, they're pretty meaningless. They're just words. So ritual has always been a part of everything. Only in the modern, very recent modern world do we simply do as we please over the course of a day. in the ancient world, the medieval world, and even the early modern world, the life of the common people in an Orthodox society was highly ritualized. Everything was a ritual. And this was to make the transition between the ideal and grace on the one hand and the day-to-day practical experience on the other as seamless as possible. That's what a ritual is. And so to say that the entire nation was meant to be a monastery is not an exaggeration.
So the example that was set is like an ethno-monastery. Are the monasteries today, the Orthodox monasteries, are they ethnically specific? Do they just cater for a specific ethnicity?
Yeah, on Mount Athos, the different monasteries are organized for different languages. You know, Hollandor is Serbian, St. Pantaleon is Russian. There's a bunch of the rest of them are Greek. There's a Bulgarian one. Sometimes they go to the Russian one. So you know, there's definitely a difference between Slavic and Greek monasteries. There's a Georgian one. So just like Orthodoxy itself, monasticism on Athos is organized ethnically. So it is an ethnic movement because there has to be a shared sense of history for and a shared language for these people to even know what's going on. You know, and they differ in terms of their patron saints and stuff like that. Greek and Russian saints are different from one another. And so who they're going to stress in terms of the lines of the saints you have to follow are going to be different. And that's based on ethnicity as well.
Well, that's fantastic. So we've got an ethnically specific tradition that goes back thousands of years. That was a really good question sent in by Okama from Bulgaria in the chat room. Matt, thank you very much for coming on today. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I'm sure the listeners will have as well. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Hopefully I'll be back tomorrow. I'm not quite sure who with. So until then, hail victory.
Listening to the Daily Traditionalist on Radio Arian.